Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Full Chat, the weekly F1 news and discussion show that can't afford to change concept anytime soon, so I'm afraid you're stuck with us like this for the whole season. I'm Brad Philpott, and as always, I've done my best to filter through this week's busy news cycle to find the best F1 content, and we want you to add your views and join in the discussion in our live YouTube chat. We run a Twitter space during our recording, but we completely ignore the listeners on there, so if you're one of them, search Full Chat F1 on YouTube and get involved in the chatting. Remember, any super chat questions get a guaranteed answer from the panel, but even if you're a cheapskate and don't pay us money, we'll probably answer you anyway. Tonight, we assess just how inevitable a year of Red Bull and Verstappen domination is and try to offer some hope for the season ahead. We give our opinions about the dilemma facing the Mercedes team and discuss the best way forward. In history with Alex and Brad, we remember some of the other times when a team has looked set to annihilate the field after round one and assess just how common a situation like this is. And as always, we answer your questions in real time as you send them in. Joining me, as always, a lifelong Fernando Alonso fan who was thrilled to see his favourite driver make the podium in Bahrain, my co-host and best mate, Alex Vangene. How's it going, Alex?
It's nice to have a reprieve from the fat jokes, because according to a review that we had this week, I'm not that fat, which I appreciate, but you're wrong. I'm gonna drop some bombs on how I really feel about Fernando this week.
Right, so the only reason there wasn't an Alex Vangene fat-related joke on the intro
is jokes.
I just ran out. I've just used so many. I mean, if anyone wants to send me in some offensive things to say about Alex at the start of the show.
Let's just have a call-in of people to recommend fat jokes for me.
Exactly.
Not to give me a complex that I really need to start eating healthier. I'm going to have a heart attack at 40.
And just so everyone knows, in case you're a new listener to Full Chat, Alex isn't an Alonso fan, but I think we're probably going to give him some props tonight for his performance. So I'm predicting...
I will compliment his driving, and that is about it.
Also joining us tonight is a slimy, gloating, fun-hating sport ruiner who's over the moon that Super Max is going to super win all of the super fucking races. It's good friend of the show and president of the Christian Horner fan club, Danny Henney. Great to have you back, Danny.
Thanks, Brad. Really appreciate that intro. I was coming on to be quite gentle tonight, but I shall just reach over and grab my salt now, if that's how it's going to be.
This is clearly all your fault, so thanks for ruining our year, Danny. Before we get going, a quick reminder, if you're joining us on the Twitter space, you won't hear the music or the bumpers, so if you want to get involved in the chat, see what we look like, and have no weird gaps where there's no sound between the topics, head to YouTube. The link's on my Twitter profile, or search for Full Chat F1. So, what have you been up to this week, Alex? Apart from laughing.
Apart from dying. I've just had a massive coughing fit because that intro for Danny, because that's the best thing I've ever heard. And a perfect way to describe Danny. I'm going to change him to Slimy Danny in my phone. It's brilliant. What have I done this week? I built a Lego Formula One car.
Yes, you won that at my Christmas party, didn't
you? I did. I won that at your Christmas party. And when I started building it, I thought I'd lost a piece. Which probably turns out I'd fitted that piece somewhere else. because
just like the real Ferrari engine department.
Like the real Ferrari, and I fitted a slightly smaller piece in its place. And I mean, I had loads of bits left over, a bit like the Ferrari engine people. So I built Charles Leclerc's Ferrari F1 car this week.
Stephen Finley in the chat says Alex isn't fat; he just has massive side pods. So, and that is the correct concept.
Big Ben.
Yeah. Okay. We also apologise for F1 data analysis from Twitter not being on this week. We were planning to have him on, and he will be on next week. But he had some other plans that couldn't be moved, and so we'll get all of his data insights next week. So I'll tell you what, let's jump in to this week's topics. So let's not beat around the bush. Topic number one is the Bahrain Grand Prix results. We've got a pretty obvious favourite for the championship, haven't we? Is that a good way of putting it? Red Bull are bloody miles ahead. So that's probably the number one story.
When Max came across the line after lap one and was 1.4 seconds ahead, I just had that envisioned from the movie Armageddon, where the guy gets blown up and the guy just goes, "Bye, Max," as he flies off into space, which is exactly the way that I felt about the start of that race. So while me and you were crying, the person who's also joined our chat was doing the opposite.
So it was really for me when I was watching the gaps. I actually downloaded the F1 app and was looking at the live timings. I haven't always done that, but I thought, invest in it for this year, looking forward optimistically to the season ahead. It was when I started seeing the gap go up to like 1.5 seconds a lap. And then I was looking at the gap to the Mercedes actually, because that's really where I was. That's where I cared. It was obvious that Leclerc was falling slightly behind, but I just wanted to see how bad the problem was. And at one point it was like 2.2 seconds a lap. And I thought, nope, everyone is screwed. And it turns out in the end, it wasn't even like Red Bull were pushing that hard.
No, it was, as a Red Bull fan, I must admit, I was a bit worried going into the weekend. It looked a lot closer Friday than probably expected. And all the noise coming out of testing, qualifying looked to be a little bit closer as well. But yeah, I must admit, after them first three laps of the race, even I was a bit, oh my God, this is quite a big advantage. You pulled something like a second a lap and then just backed off and just proceeded to cruise away. So it's a good job we had Alonso to give us a bit of entertainment.
Yeah, so Ferrari really were the ones that we were expecting to be able to at least take the fight to Red Bull. But even the Ferrari challenge, Charles Leclerc's reliability aside, which did turn out to be an electrical failure, the news has come out today. So I'm glad I diagnosed that correctly, because they were saying it was an engine failure. But obviously the engine stopped working because the electrics weren't working.
The engine turned off. It didn't. You normally hear a bang or a pop or something mechanical make a noise, and it didn't. Yeah. It just turned off.
It sounded like there was no ignition. It was like things are turning around, but there's no spark happening. Anyway, all that stuff aside, it was clear the pace wasn't there. And Leclerc was... it was the anomaly of the Ferraris anyway, in being at least, you know, able to challenge a bit or look a bit of a threat in qualifying. Sainz has kind of fallen back into his standard number two role, and I think that's probably where he's going to be for the full season.
Which is a real shame, because we had such high hopes for Sainz last season, and we're like, okay, well, he doesn't quite get on with the car. Then he obviously won in Silverstone. So it's like, okay, maybe he'll be better this year. And then obviously, as you just said, had the good run in practice and qualifying, and vanished in the race.
And the team that really ended up, well, second in the Constructors' Championship, but without a poor start, probably closer to being on pace the second fastest car in the race, was the Aston Martin. I think maybe Leclerc would have stayed ahead, but I think also Alonso's early lap dramas, where he fell behind a little bit, maybe masked how fast they could have gone in the race.
Yeah, I think if Alonso had been in his rightful position and not got done by Lewis on the first lap, I think that would have been a lot of a closer race than we expected with Charlie up front. I think he'd have probably caught him. Looking at the tyre degradation that the Ferrari had, it looked horrendous. And to be honest, it's quite disappointing that the car looks the same as it did last season. It looks like it's going to be a super qualifying car and then just proceed to go backwards in the race. They might win one or two races if they're lucky, but yeah, a bit of a poor job from Ferrari again.
I think it might even be worse than last season because, well, it definitely is worse because Leclerc was on pole for the first race, and when Ferrari were good at the beginning of the season, they were genuinely good. You know, they were a real threat and they were winning on merit or being out front on merit, even if they had their problems. But this year, they don't look a threat at all. They look like, you know, when Perez is able to be ahead of them, that shows you that the Red Bull has a good margin.
On the softer, higher deck tyre, where he just cruised up to the back of Leclerc, passed him easily and pissed off. I mean, let's hope that it's a freak result, and it just
it's not a freak result.
Shut up, and the car just works here. But the last time there was a gap this big after race one was 2016, and the time before then was 2010.
And so we've got a segment later on some particularly dominant seasons, but I can see this one being added to that list the next time we have a discussion like this. I think I can't remember being as pessimistic about the race for the win, and we can talk about the race for third place, which maybe is where what we should call first place from now on. I don't remember there being a time where the win has been such a foregone conclusion, but maybe that's because when it was Mercedes winning, I didn't care as much because I liked them winning. I'm sure that's what it is, actually.
I think it's definitely plays into it. If your driver is winning, then it's certainly not that much of a big deal what the pace deficit is behind. And I think that's only natural, irrelevant of who you support, really. But yeah, so I must admit, I'm quite surprised how down you two are. You've got, it's one race in the season. There's a long season to go. Mercedes will come back and do better.
I'm not that down in the sense. I mean, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in Mercedes not giving a car that can fight with, when we all kind of thought before testing that Mercedes would have figured it out because they had a good car, or they'd got to a point where the car was raceable at the end of last year. They got rid of all the porpoising, so we thought, oh great, they'll be there. And then obviously we all thought it was low engine modes in testing and things like that, and it just hasn't turned up. However, after the race, in the interviews, do you see how happy and smiley Lewis was? I've never seen him so happy with a fifth place before. He just enjoyed racing. He actually harked back to, he said it reminds him of the days when he was racing in the midfield when he was at McLaren, and he just loved the battles that he had today, on Sunday, because he had great battles with a great competitor who races fairly in Fernando Alonso.
Out of all of them, I must admit, it was Lewis I thought was, like you said, the most positive out of everybody. I was quite surprised how down everybody else was. I mean, Toto Wolff was totally obliterated by his comments coming out. I think worrying for me was what that will do to the morale back at base. If you were a designer in that team, that's not really the comments what you want to hear. George Russell as well, you know, he seemed a bit down. But yeah, I'm weird. I thought Lewis was quite positive and took the approach of let's get a red stand and come back stronger.
So I think that bodes well, because he's going to need to remain that kind of positive and be happy to be fighting in the midfield if he's got any hopes of, you know, winning eighth title or maybe even ever winning a race again. If he's down and he's not feeling it, and he's, you know, he's in the same kind of mood as me and Alex are, or certainly me, he's not going to hang around until that car's good enough. But I think seeing how positive he was afterwards means that at least he's happy that he can drive without being bounced around, which this time last year obviously wasn't the case. They obviously had a fundamental ride issue, and maybe it seems more simple, like a more simple problem. Just give us more grip and then we'll be faster. And obviously the Aston Martin demonstrating that the mechanical platform of the car is sound. Not that Aston Martin were on Red Bull's pace. There's still obviously a big gap there, but it shows that there's not a fundamental issue with the car's mechanics. They just need to whack on some downforce. And I say that as if it's easy, but obviously it's definitely not.
It's interesting. You talk about Lewis not winning another race. I think Danny told me this stat, so he'll correct me. Is it after hitting 300 races, no one's ever won a race again?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. No one's won a race after hitting 300 races. Now, don't get me wrong, there's only a couple of drivers got to that stat, but Yeah, nobody's ever hit 300 races and won a race again.
That will change this year because I firmly believe Alonso will win a race. So although I think Red Bull are super, super dominant, and in a normal situation where nothing weird happens, they're going to walk basically all the races. They're over a Formula One season, especially one as long as this one, there are going to be weird things happen. There's going to be weird weather. There's going to be failures. There's going to be accidents, etc., etc. And Alonso is going to probably be the one in a position to pick up those pieces when that happens. So I reckon that stat will be gone this year, probably along with some others. I don't know exactly how many records Alonso is sitting on that will change, you know, oldest driver to do whatever. But
even though they've got much better, I don't think Red Bull are capable of putting a season together without at least one engine going pop or one mechanical failure or Max crashing into somebody.
Low Stealth in the chat says Alonso will win if Aston Martin use a tactical stroll strike to take out Max. He nearly used a tactical stroll strike to take out Alonso. They were so lucky on that first lap that they both carried on.
I have heard rumours that that Aston Martin are trying to employ Flabio Briatore.
Okay.
So it's Singapore.
For what? What on earth?
So if Singapore, if Stroll crashes, we know why.
Hang on, is this a joke? Is this a complete joke? Okay. I was just desperately trying to think, what on earth could he do that would be useful for the team? Right, you're just making an elaborate joke about how Flavio Briatore is there, someone's going to crash on purpose. Cool. I don't think they're going to need that this year. Renault that season needed something like that safety car to happen at exactly the right time. Aston Martin are going to do some stuff on merit this year.
We will definitely cover that Singapore race in a History with Alex and Brad 1 week, 100%.
Yes. Definitely. So Joe DeGraff, I think that's how you pronounce it, in the chat, says great wheel-to-wheel action. That is something positive. So I mentioned in the Twitter post, we're going to take some positives from today. The wheel-to-wheel action of particularly Alonso coming through the field, I have to give him massive props because, in fact, Hamilton as well, they battled cleanly. It's nice that we've now got a data point to see that Alonso isn't just going to... I mean, you mentioned it earlier. He drove fairly. He raced correctly. They both gave each other the right amount of room. They were able to race hard but not run each other off the track and not bang into each other. It was great. If we can see more of that through the season, the respect is clearly there. That's awesome.
It's proper old school racing as far as I'm concerned, where you give your opponent space to exist and continue the fight. You know, we almost saw Alonso Binnett as he tried to tighten up on Lewis through turn four, and then he managed to hold on to it, and then they fought through a couple more corners, and then the wily old fox pulled a really good move on Lewis into turn 10, which is, I mean, we can talk about the dynamics of that move and how that move could be pulled off. You obviously have to have more superior grip, which Alonso definitely had, but also it's a very difficult corner because that corner is downhill, off camber. You have to be turning and braking at the same time as the track drops away. And what that does is it increases the opportunity for lockups, which we've seen lots of, and then people running wide. In that situation, if Alonso was up the inside and had locked up, he'd have smashed straight into Lewis. But Lewis saw Alonso take that move and knew it was done, so gave enough room for Alonso to exist and to potentially have an error and not cause a problem, and then tried to undercut him, but didn't quite have the traction.
That move, though, was done back at turn four when you watch correct. It. He set it up at turn four and got him out of position going through the next couple of corners to where Lewis was off to the left, and he knew he could make the cut back on him. And I think he said if he'd have gone to the inside, he'd have just gone around the outside and got the run on the exit. But that was brilliant. If you were around in 2008, 2009, when they really had some niggle, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I was like, here we go. This is going to be amazing. It's the first time in however long I can remember that these two have got a genuine car to have a proper battle. It was great. I loved it.
And as Stephen Finley says in the chat, Alonso also knew that even if he hadn't managed to pull that move off into turn 10, Lewis defending that move, he'd have been easy meat up the following straight into the next corner. And that's the whole point of when it comes to racing, and it's a good thing that the three of us are on. All of us have done plenty of racing. Okay, not in Formula One cars, but racing is racing no matter what you're driving. It's all about strategically placing your car through various corners to outfox the other driver. Moves don't always just happen in one corner at the drop of a hat. It's something you have to plan.
So that move up the inside, that where he got it done in the end, where Alonso finally got through. I've seen a few people on Twitter say, oh, this is another example of Lewis just leaving the door open on the inside. But that is definitely... I have criticised Lewis myself for certain things. I think he left the door open in the final lap at Abu Dhabi. I think Verstappen would have got past him anyway later in the lap, but I think it was the wrong place to try and leave room and cut back. However, this was not an example of that. This was... people don't make a move down that inside in Formula One normally, especially on like reasonably worn tyres. Alonso just absolutely hooked it up. He couldn't have done a better job. And like Danny said, he set it up earlier in the lap. And it was happening at some point anyway. You saw how far away he pulled from Hamilton after that. It wasn't worth fighting that, and Lewis is sensible enough to know that.
But that's also such a valid point, is, and you see this a lot in sim racing, where people fight when there isn't much point in fighting. You know, you've caught somebody 3 seconds a lap and they defend like they're fighting for a championship. It's like, oh, you hadn't seen me 3 laps ago and now I'm bearing down on you.
It might be
sensible for you to not hold us both up. Maybe get behind me and follow me and you might go quicker.
So we've covered... this is basically as in-depth of a race review as we're going to end up doing, because we are not Never. One of the shows that does a race review. There's enough of those, and they're generally out well before this show comes out on a Tuesday night. So this is our first ever episode after a Formula One race has just happened. And you've heard us talk about a couple of key things that we enjoyed, and we're going to touch on a couple more later. I've got some more in my list of other things that happened in the race that we enjoyed. But really, the next question that follows naturally from what we've just been talking about is, what's next for Mercedes? So we've heard talk of concepts a lot. We've heard the word concept used over and over. Mercedes need to make a total change of concept. You know, the car isn't working as it is. They've had a whole extra winter to look into it, and it's still not good enough. So we need to change the concept. Alex, what's a concept?
The philosophy, the way the car is designed, and the pattern that they have gone through to come up with the car that they currently have. You know, Aston Martin have got these water slide type side pods. Mercedes have gone for zero pods, and it just doesn't look like they're working.
So are you saying concept is like just the side pods, or
no, the whole philosophy of the car?
So yeah, the way I understand it,
front to
back, I'll let Danny have his say as well. It's basically the whole shape of everything, and in this generation of cars, a big part of that is the stuff we can't see, unfortunately, the underfloor. But it's not, from everything I've heard, everything I've read, changing the concept doesn't just mean putting on some side pods that are a different shape. That's really a sticking plaster that, and Mercedes have said it themselves, they've tried different pod concepts, side pod concepts. They've tried the kinds of shapes that other teams have got. And obviously they're not trying them as part of a completely designed package for their car, but they've tried something similar and they can't see the gains. So it's not quite as simple as going, we'll just look at the Red Bull and we'll do that. They have to fundamentally basically change everything.
Every little bit of the car is interacting with each other. And like you say, the concept is derived probably 18 months before the car hits the track. So they've set off down a path of how they're going to generate, in simple terms, downforce across the car. And it's just not worked. And as you say, it's not a... you couldn't, for example, go and put a front wing on or some side pods or a new rear wing in it, and it all of a sudden fix the problem, because it won't interact with the rest of the car the way that it's, you know, the rest of the car has been designed to work. So it is going to be painful. I do think they can recover, but yeah.
Wipe that smile off your face,
Harry. Yeah, it's been a shocker. I actually thought they would have done something different this season. I was very shocked to see the zero pods stay there when pretty much every other team principal has said, you know, we've looked at that concept and we don't believe it gives any benefit. So they've got to change sooner or later, and it sounds like they're going to try and do it sooner.
So the reason people mention the side pods, I think, a lot in conjunction with the talk about the concept is because that is definitely the most obvious thing. That's the most obvious difference on the Mercedes to the other cars of this generation. But that will just follow from everything else that the car is made of. The shape of the front wing, the turning vanes at the front, the way that all interacts with the floor, and obviously the rear wing, etc. And so the way that their upper body surfaces are shaped is obviously from scratch designed to interact with all the other things upstream and downstream that they've designed. And so they're going to have to really, really take a look at it in more detail, you know, really put a bit more effort into making some of the kinds of philosophies of the other cars or the other teams, try and really make them work, because it seems pretty clear that that direction, certainly Red Bull have managed to make that work. It seems pretty clear that that's where the greater headroom is. There's obviously a reason why Mercedes have been so firm in their, or certainly Toto Wolff in his analysis that this isn't going to be enough. You know,
I saw a really good post somewhere. I can't remember where it was, but they were on about, and this would probably be a bit controversial, but has it come to Mercedes where their egos got in front of them a little bit? How everybody's trying to say that the Red Bull's clearly the fastest car, everybody's copying that. And this guy was saying about, you know, has their ego got in the way where they're kind of too proud to say, well, we want to go and copy the Red Bull to get performance. So they're sticking to the guns in the belief that obviously the zero pod concept will work. Unsure from my point of view if there's any truth in that, but I thought it was a good question of reading. And is the, you know, is there a potential bit of truth in it?
I think it's more to do with the fact they've lost a lot of stuff to the likes of Red Bull and Ferrari and up and down the grid, because that's what happens to the best teams. If there's a senior technical person and you're two steps down the line and you get offered a big promotion at Ferrari or Red Bull or any other teams down the grid, you're going to take it. So if you're a valuable member of that team, they lose that person's information. So I do think that they've stripped a lot. Aston Martin have taken a lot of people. I can't remember what the numbers were, but they have massively increased their staffing numbers, and that has directly related to increase in pace, because no less than obviously Dan Fallows, who's obviously put together a really good concept for this car, but then all the other team around them that they've pinched from other places is what makes success. And maybe Mercedes, as far as staff is concerned, are running a bit lean.
So I think it's a couple of things on Danny's point about it being ego getting in the way. I think it's more that you've got this sunk cost of having gone down a development route, and you're already, that's the route you've committed to. You've already spent a lot of time and money and effort on developing a car that works with that philosophy. It's improved towards the end of last year. It showed signs of promise. It got a 1-2 at Brazil. It's obviously, once the bouncing was sorted, last year at least, it was looking like maybe that was still the right way to go. And to take this big step back and try and completely change will set you back a long way. So I think probably the main thing is just the desire to make this one work, because you're already so far down that road. I don't think the staff thing is a bad shout either. Although, as Toto Wolff said, Aston Martin and Ferrari, talking about them having a better car than Mercedes is kind of a sideshow, because the real gap is to Red Bull. Those two teams also have a big gap to Red Bull. So saying Dan Fallows and, you know, the other staff that have gone from other teams to Aston Martin and helped them make a great car, the car is not that much better than the Mercedes. That, I think if Mercedes stuck with this concept, they could probably outdevelop Aston Martin and end the season with a better car than Aston Martin. The problem is, Aston Martin are still miles off of Red Bull in reality. And Toto and probably the wider Mercedes family, their aim is to be the fastest, not second fastest in front of the others.
But it is the jump that Aston Martin have made this season. They've gone from the sixth fastest car to the third, possibly second fastest car in the space of one season break. That's really impressive. It all depends on how much they can develop. I mean, to take for our guest who is going to be on today, he's produced some amazing data over the weekend. And one of those, and the phrase he kept using was, the Aston Martin is a downforce monster. That's the word he kept using, which means it's probably got the most downforce on the grid. However, my understanding is, because I have I've got a little contact all over the place now. I've got a contact inside Aston Martin who said their car.
You're well connected.
I am. So sometimes I actually do know what I'm talking about. He sent me a nice little picture today of the trophy, of Alonso's trophy.
See if you can send a picture of the underfloor, and we'll pass that on to our friends at Mercedes.
What he did tell me is the car is a bit draggy. So that could be part of the reason. So if they can make the car a little bit slipperier make the downforce more efficient, we could see that car moving forward. So it all depends on how they can develop. And obviously, they're talking about development through this season. That's one thing that might hamper Red Bull. Probably by the time they wrap up the championship, they won't be able to develop the car anymore. But oh well, they've wrapped up the championship by that point.
And Aston Martin's position at the end of last season means they actually, out of the teams at the front, they've got by far the most wind tunnel time to use, etc., and most development ability. So if they use it well, then there's no reason why Aston Martin shouldn't be able to maintain or maybe move forward with their performance. Whereas Mercedes have a bit less, and Red Bull have even less, but they don't really care about sticking to that anyway. So, and they're far enough in front that it doesn't matter.
It's interesting what you say around the dragginess, because I noticed that when we were watching the race. If you watched when Alonso was behind Hamilton with the DRS, he didn't really close that much, I thought, when he was behind him. The minute it reversed and Hamilton was in Alonso's DRS, he was zooming right up to the back of that Aston Martin. So
yeah,
you're right, their development path has got to definitely address that going forward, else they're going to be caught and caught very quickly.
Jacob S. in the chat says, I think they got transfixed with their porpoising problem, turned their attention to solving that rather than making the car go fast, and got tricked by Brazil Grand Prix last year. And I think that is a large part of it. They've admitted it themselves. They lost a large part of the year trying to fix that problem. This year, that isn't a problem, but they are just now miles away. And I think also the fact that the gap seemed to be narrowing towards the end of last year may have also lulled them into a false sense of security into continuing down that path.
We need to remember as well. We need to remember as well, even though they won in Brazil, it was more of a Red Bull mess up with the tyres, etc., that they couldn't get the car to work on the tyres rather than Mercedes all of a sudden finding this big performance where they've blew the field away. I mean, it was a great performance, don't get me wrong, and they fully deserved the win, but it wasn't like they'd done a big upgrade and then all of a sudden jumped to the front of the grid.
There's a really good interview, one of the post-race interviews with Lewis, where he talks about the fact that he's raced lots of different types of cars that perform in different ways, and he has learned what a car needs and what a car doesn't need, and that he put a lot of input into the car throughout the season, which got followed, and that's when the car starts to improve. But then he put a lot of input into the car for this season, and while widely ignored him, apparently, and the car doesn't handle the way he wants it to, and they've basically admitted to him that they didn't take his points on board and that they probably should have.
So here we go then. Let's say Mercedes are going to struggle to close that gap and unlikely to do it this season. But the race for second/third place in the teams, let's forget that Red Bull are the top two positions on the grid, but the second place team battle is actually really good. So are we against rules? Why don't we just bring in some rules just to slow down Red Bull? What do we think about that? Obviously, Danny's shaking his head.
No,
I'm also shaking my head. I hate
success ballast.
I still have nightmares about 2005. It still lights
to the new F1 fans. Explain what happened in 2005, Danny.
So from 2000, obviously Michael Schumacher had began to dominate and take his championships. And at the end of 2004, because he'd won every season, the view was that it was too dominant, etc. And they rewrote the rules to stop him from dominating. And because Ferrari were mainly with Bridgestone, they changed it so the tyres had to last the whole race rather than a sprint race, what had been pretty much the preceding couple of years. But I think they should have gone about it a different way. But yeah, that certainly still stings me, because it was like artificial clawing back, if you will. And I certainly didn't think it was fair at the time, because it was done on purpose to claw back one team. Equally, whether it was Mercedes or Red Bull or Ferrari, I'm not personally a fan of artificial slowing teams down, if you will. And as Alex said, success ballast is like, yeah, no racer wants to hear that you're going to have to carry an extra bit of weight if that was an idea what anybody come up with down the line either.
So what about Low Stealth's comment in the chat that they nerfed the Mercedes in 2021? So this has happened recently. The rules changed specifically to favour the Red Bull concept. So Mercedes went from 2020 with a car and their philosophy in that season, absolutely the right one for that season's rules package. For 2021, we went to a philosophy that favoured higher rate cars, and the Mercedes was effectively, you know, brought down a peg. And we had obviously a very tight championship fight, but if the rules had stayed static and hadn't been changed, you know, there was no other reason for that rules change other than to end a bit of Mercedes dominance. And they obviously very nearly went to win anyway in 2021 and still won the Constructors' Championship. So they obviously had a good performance gap. I'd argue it was at no point quite as big as what we've seen from Red Bull this weekend. Why are we against this? Because I'm also on your side, Danny. I don't think we should be specifically changing rules with a view to as Alex says, neutering teams. I'm old enough and ugly enough, definitely ugly enough, to have lived through Formula One in lots of eras, as we're going to discuss later on, where there has just been a dominant team. We've just had to accept it. I mean, my prime F1 years as a younger person were the Schumacher years. Hated it. Hated every weekend knowing that Schumacher was always going to win every single race. But it kept happening and I kept watching because at some point it was going to end. And you're addicted to the sport. At some point, the drivers that I wanted to do well were going to do well, whether it was a freak result or whether it was just the end of that period of domination. So why is it okay that it happened to Mercedes? Or isn't it?
I don't think it is. As I say, I don't think any team that's dominating should be clawed back artificially.
So you're saying the 2021 Drivers' Championship was a fraud?
No, definitely not saying that. Far from that. But I do think it was pretty harsh to make the rules and do the change that obviously did impact Mercedes. And I think everybody would have to agree it was specifically to claw Mercedes back a little bit. But equally, the 2020 rules should have come in. The 2022 rules, sorry, should have come in 21. So it was like a halfway house that we're trying to do, I think, hoping that the big rules reset was going to shuffle the grid up. And obviously, it's looking like it has done currently.
But also, in the middle of last year, they tried to change a rule to slow Red Bull down, and it did absolutely nothing. Because, and as I have from a really reliable source, Red Bull changed nothing. When that regulation changed, Ferrari had to change shitloads. Mercedes had to change a few things, and Red Bull pulled even further away. So sometimes making a rule change when you don't know what you're changing a rule for actually doesn't make sense either.
Ben Williamson in the chat says, rule change in a cost cap era also removes the ability to adapt, double hit. I think one of the problems that Mercedes have with this particular problem, and we will move on to another subject soon, because I know you're all bored of this misery, except Danny, who's just drinking the tears of Team LH. I think the problem
ratings will go up in the Netherlands this week.
Yes. The problem for Mercedes is that they cannot spend their way out of this unless they just either have a bunch of money to spare in their cost cap budget, which I doubt they have, or they just break the cost cap budget like some other teams might have done and hope to not get too harsh a penalty, because effectively, as we've seen with the Red Bull situation, if you get it right early on, that performance advantage is baked in for that generation of cars. And even if you get pegged back with a penalty, you know, Red Bull will suffer some kind of development penalty later this year. They'll feel the effects of that. If you're that far ahead anyway, if you've already got the advantage, then it doesn't matter that much. The damage is already done. So Mercedes are stuck between a rock and a hard place. Anything more to say on the Mercedes situation, panel?
No.
As much as it is nice to see them struggling, and I'm going to go there because I'm still sore from the intro, but as much as it is to see them struggling, what I will say is after 5 years of it, then I'll start to have a bit of sympathy. But I do think they'll come back. I can't see an organisation like Mercedes. Yes, they've got it wrong last year. They've got it wrong this year, it looks like. But they'll be back. They're massive. They've got winners across the board. They've got top drivers, top personnel. I think you're only going to take the... As much as it pains me to say this, I think you're only going to take pain this season. I think next season they'll be straight back towards the top and win.
Don't give me hope. Please don't give me hope.
They're too big to fail.
But the thing, you make a really valid point though when you talk about, you know, I'm not going to have sympathy because you've had 7 years of it, and I understand that, and you know, there's a lot of very passionate fans out there who are really projectile throwing toys out of their prams because of Mercedes not doing well. I think if you're a big Hamilton fan, like I am, like Brad is, you don't like seeing the driver who you feel got cheated out of his eighth title and now doesn't have that opportunity to refight, to retake his crown. It feels like something's been stolen from you, and it's very easy to start throwing a fit and getting very upset about it. But this is what happens in this sport. You get, and we will talk more about this later, but you get eras of dominance where somebody just gets it right and no one can catch up. And we might have to go through, and by we, I say Hamilton fans, Mercedes fans, George Russell fans, Ferrari fans, might just have to go through with this for a little bit until somebody comes up with a concept that can take it to the Red Bull.
I think the lack of karmic justice is still hurts the Mercedes or Hamilton fans, because there hasn't been a good bit really since the really bad bit at the end of 2021. It was building to a good crescendo for that fan base, and you know, for all the wrongs that we've covered that happened that day, we haven't had a good thing happen since. And the one time where it was about to happen, or potentially about to happen, Verstappen bloody hit Hamilton again at Brazil last year. So LH8144 in the chat says, it's always like this. Grew up hating Schumacher dominance. Didn't care about a driver during the Mercedes era. And it was boring. This is the sport. And you know, I think we're probably in agreement. We don't want it artificially changed. It's up to the other teams to sort their stuff out.
But I also think we were very much sold the dream with the cost cap and the new regulations that it was going to bring everything closer. It succeeded in actually making the racing better, because when cars do get near each other, they can race and they can follow. They succeeded on that. However, the cost cap isn't working at the moment.
I think the cost cap is a long-term thing. So I still don't think even in the next year or two from now we can really say whether the cost cap has worked. But one thing it has definitely done is prevent big teams like Mercedes, who have got it wrong, from spending their way out of trouble quickly. So you can argue that's a good thing or a bad thing. But
I have a really small point. Luke Maxwell in the chat says, what percentage of Red Bull's dominance is down to Adrian Newey? Now, something I have to make a point of, and people keep praising Adrian Newey for the last few years of cars, when Adrian Newey does not design the car anymore. The concept is not Adrian Newey's. He gets heavily involved in the front suspension arms, and he gets heavily involved in the setup of the cars on race.
He loves those suspension arms.
He loves those suspension arms. But he does not design that full concept and philosophy of the car. Of course, he works in and around the teams, but it is not, there is no car that is one person's vision anymore. He doesn't sit there on his easel, because the whole famous thing of he doesn't use CAD for anything. He used to hand draw everything.
I can teach him Photoshop.
You can't. Yeah, look at our little purple car on our logo. Brad can make that.
Just on Adrian Newey, while you bring it up, I did see a funny thing someone shared the other day saying actually the cost cap break weren't for sandwiches, it was for Adrian Newey's stationary cupboard.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Credit for that goes to Engine Mode 11 on Twitter. I'm pretty sure I saw him write that, and that was very funny indeed. I think we've probably had enough Mercedes misery for the moment. Let's move on to other interesting things from the first round. So before we move on to history with Alex and Brad and Danny today, let's just touch upon a couple of things that we enjoyed from the first race. So Danny, what did you think about Logan Sargeant's first lap?
I actually was really impressed with Logan Sargeant. I think I messaged Alex in the group and said Logan Sargeant's done more in one lap than Latifi did in his whole career.
I like that assessment. I think that's true. That first lap looked great. If you've not seen the replay, Google it or check it out on YouTube.
I must admit, I was a bit unsure with him coming into the sport because he weren't one of the big headliners you usually see coming up. Watched him in the lower categories and he looked a solid driver, nothing special. But I thought he did really well. I thought he did really, really solid. I was super impressed and he was only a couple of seconds behind Albon, was it?
About 10 seconds at the flag, I think. Yeah, not too far at all. And there were no safety cars. We had a virtual safety car, but nothing that closed the gaps up. I lost a 25 pence bet, by the way. I put 25p. On there being a safety car. I thought that was quite a safe bet, but it turned out to be wrong.
Bradley, I've told you this before in private. Do not start gambling. It's not for you.
I'm not a gambler at all. I'm really not a gambler at all. I put a series of very small bets just to try, and all of them failed.
Our mates Kyle and Richard are regular bettors and do not get sucked in. I will not have this show jeopardized because you get a gambling problem.
Connor Edwards asked me to go to Las Vegas. You pay for the flights. I'm there. I'll get it all wrong there as well and lose more money there.
On a serious note, yeah, don't go down the betting road. I had a guy who works for me at work get me into the horses at Cheltenham. Totally off topic here, but I quickly escalated into, I was spending 20 to 30, 40, 50 quid a week on bets. And
that's why Danny is broadcasting today from his mum's basement.
I thought you were going to talk about your venture into Bitcoin, Danny.
Yeah, I tried Bitcoin.
That's a whole other show. Let's not do that.
Tried Bitcoin, quickly got out of it. I made a little bit of money, but yeah, I'm just saying for everyone watching, betting is not something you want to go into lightly.
So Paul Handley has given us our first super chat of the day, but he hasn't asked a question. So
we will take your money, Paul.
I'll wait for Paul to ask a question. I did see him comment earlier just the word bonjour, but I don't think that really is what the super chat was about. So other interesting things from the first race. McLaren have major problems. So we said last week on the show that McLaren were in a bad position. We put it a bit more strongly than that. On pace, they actually weren't right at the back, but the car couldn't do more than a handful of laps without needing an air top-up, which is a bit strange. Any news on McLaren? Any information on why they were having so many problems?
I think their philosophy, a bit like Mercedes, they've just got it wrong from the news they were coming out in testing, weren't it? They've kind of come up with a way they want to go, and apparently as soon as they got the car launched up and started looking into it, they weren't pleased from day one, which is never a good sign. So I think they're similar boat to Mercedes, really. They've got to make a decision on, do they scrap the season and try and come back next year, or try and push on with the concept they've got currently and try and get a few results over the season, if you will. But you can clearly see the frustration on Lando Norris as well. I feel so sorry for that guy. He's such a driver. And I think if this carries on this season, I think he'll be looking for a way out to get to a different team.
So I actually heard a bit more information about the McLaren pace situation. Although they weren't the slowest, they realised when the 15 mil was it 15 mil?
15 mil
floor,
yeah, race? 15 mil.
God, it doesn't sound very much. 15 mil is really small. Anyway, they realised that.
1.5 centimetres.
Yeah, I don't know why I was always thinking of it as 15 centimetres. You know, mentally, 1.5 centimetres doesn't feel like a lot. Obviously, for the sensitive floors of a Formula One car, it's huge. And McLaren realised early on that for their particular concept, that actually was a worse thing than it was for some other cars. So they'd already done a bunch of work down one path, but late last year they had to kind of scrap that. And what they've ended up with at the start of this year is kind of a continuation of last year, because they just haven't had time to ready more of a radical new concept. And I've heard from Baku onwards, they really do have a kind of B-spec coming. Mercedes were
supposed to be having a kind of 2 to 3 tenth upgrade coming around Imola, which now may be shelved, we're hearing. But McLaren are definitely pressing ahead with this major update for Baku.
I didn't think Toto said they were shelving it. He just said it's not going to be enough.
So they have a decision to make, Mercedes, and I know we're back on Mercedes. They've got to decide, do we continue pressing ahead with this upgrade to the current concept and spend the money on that, you know, getting it manufactured, because it's obviously not made yet, otherwise it would already be on the car. Do we carry on with that, or do we just say pause on that or cancel it and allocate that money and all of the work that would be going into that 2 to 3 tenth upgrade to go towards the big fundamental upgrade and just press on with the crap version of the car for the moment?
If they're in the middle of making it, hasn't the money been spent?
Some money's been spent, yeah, but that's the problem they've already had, is getting into this sunk cost fallacy where they go, well, we've already spent the money, so we might as well carry on. Sometimes you have to call it quits.
I'd really love to get someone who properly understands the financials of the cost cap to come on this show and talk to us about it, because I don't fully understand it. I don't, especially all the things that are outside of it and chicken wings and different other bits of catering that.
Danny can talk to us about that.
It was only a pickle sandwich. I don't know what you're getting so irate about.
I'd love a 450 grand pickle sandwich hidden behind a £5 million.
We are friends with a chef from Formula One, Chef Wayner on Twitter, so maybe he could come and tell us just how many sandwiches $400,000 or whatever it was can buy you. Other things that happened in the first race.
I'm going to tweet him that.
Alpine underperformed, but actually, in all the post-race analysis, this is depressing, all the post-race analyses show that they're actually pretty similar to Mercedes on pace after they, you know, if you discount the penalties that Ocon was picking up every lap and a half and Gasly's traffic and issues in qualifying, they actually were reasonably quick. Alpine are going to crop up at the front of the midfield fighting the Mercedes as the season wears on. So interesting from Alpine.
For Alpine, 2 points really. I was super impressed with Gasly. I thought him coming from the back to the front, he did a really good drive to get that far up the field.
Up to ninth by the end, wasn't
he? Yeah, he did really, really well. And Ocon, what a nightmare he had. It reminded me of when someone comes around your house and says, can I have a go in your sim rig? And you say, yeah, here you go. And they tried to get out the pit lane and end with like 7 or 8 penalties. It was just, he had such a calamity. He had every penalty going, didn't he? And I felt quite sorry for Ocon, but he just was watching it going, just park the car. Honestly, park the car and get out, son. You've had a really bad day at the office.
And that's what they did in the end. They did park the car and get out. So just to recap for those who didn't see it, and apologies, the chat can correct me if I'm wrong, but Ocon got an initial 5-second penalty for being out of position on the grid. So he let the car roll too far forward, and that was a penalty. He then picked up another penalty for not serving the first penalty correctly. And that wasn't his fault. The team started trying to change his nose before the end.
Apparently, 0.4 of a second early.
Yeah, I mean, and
so 0.4 of a second, 0.4 of a million, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What's 0.4 of a million between friends?
Just make it up.
And then he got another penalty for releasing the pit lane speed limiter too early as he left the pit. So it was just
which
kind
was
of a real,
0.1 of a mile an hour over.
A catalogue of errors. Whereas Gasly had the opposite. He had a terrible qualifying, was dead last on the grid, and came through to score points.
Hang on. Sean Kidd in the comments just said it's 0.04 seconds early.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I keep hearing 0.4, but if it's 0.04, that's insane.
And well, that just goes to show that in every sporting rule, every rule in a sport like Formula One, it doesn't matter how much under or over the thing you are. If it's not right, it's a penalty. Mercedes had that problem with Hamilton's wing, which was actually costing him performance at Brazil last year, but it was slightly out of tolerance, however many fractions of a millimetre it was. So he was stuck to the
Danny's
back.
Face.
Red Bull were...
What about the engine?
Were half a million over the cost cap, and actually it was a lot more than that, but obviously we're just talking about that bit because it kind of got changed to that when you ignore some of the other amount they were over, and they got, you know, immediate, really minor slap on the wrist. So anyway, next up on my list, Nick De Vries got a bit screwed by the strategy, but he was largely fine. He kind of was on par with Tsunoda. I think Tsunoda looked the quicker of the two over the weekend, but probably to be expected. Any De Vries comments? He was kind of anonymous for most of the race. No, that's fine. We don't need to talk about Nick de Vries. We've actually only got 7 minutes left of the hour.
I was reading Benjamin Rose's comment in the chat, which said, "I'm sorry I was late, but then I saw who the guest was."
Yeah, I was just about to say exactly the same thing. Apologies, so, yeah, Ben.
Nick de Vries. So, yeah, he got thumped by Tsunoda, didn't he?
But I think they hung him out to dry. I'm pretty sure if you were to look back at the race, they pitted him at a very inopportune time or didn't pit him. I think when the VSC came out, the cars around him pitted, took advantage of it, had fresh tyres, and he was left out there like a sitting duck. So let's not judge De Vries on that race. Mercedes pit stops were better than normal.
Sorry, on that, you can't judge any of the rookies on this one race.
Except Sargent, because we judged him as good.
You've got to give all the rookies at least half a season before you can properly start judging them. I mean, Logan Sargeant, I expected nothing from. But then in the build-up, I've been hearing that people regard him as highly as they do Piastri. And they regard Piastri as like a future massive talent.
So I think the thing is, the results he's had in the seasons he's had in the junior formula don't reflect necessarily just how good he was in each of those years. I think when you look at, I can't remember the results, but it's like seventh in one season, fourth in another, whatever. And we tend to look, unless they got first or second, we tend to discount them. I'm certainly guilty of that. But from what other people have told me, he was much closer to the championship battle or in the championship battle and than it looks from the results. Maybe his team wasn't quite as good, or maybe he had some kind of dodgy results at certain inopportune times, which bumped him down. But in terms of how fast he was, that wasn't really in question. So
it's actually interesting. I think this is the first year where legitimately everyone in the sport deserves to be in the sport.
Yes. Okay, right. You've reminded me of a thing. We haven't really spoken about Lance Stroll. So Lance Stroll is someone who you have famously said the phrase, "get out of my sport," to in the past.
That was my line. I said it on an almost weekly basis on a different podcast. And the problem, as we discussed last week about Lance, he has had enough time now to be a competent F1 driver. However, I don't think any of that quite covers what he achieved this weekend. This hurts for me to say this because I'm not a fan. But the guy had two broken wrists and a broken toe. Now, I've had a broken toe before. That really hurts, and I don't really want to stand up, let alone push my foot down on a... I'm not certain which toe it was.
It was the accelerator pedal. It was his right foot, okay, thankfully.
Still, that's a lot of movement throughout a race, not something you want to go through. But to have both of your wrists broken, go through keyhole surgery, being cast... while this was all going on, to then get in the fastest racing cars in the world and not be absolutely obliterated by Fernando Alonso, who's had a whole 3 days of testing where he did most of the time in the car, is actually really, really annoyingly impressive.
He has, in my mind, I've always had questions about his motivation, about... Does he care enough? It doesn't ever really seem like he's cared enough about being a Formula One driver. He was doing it because he could and it was kind of on a plate for him, whatever. But that has really changed this weekend for me. When I've seen some of the videos that have come out this evening of his recovery process, which was a very, very short recovery process, where both of his arms are in casts and you see the x-rays of the screws, the massive screws in his wrists, and the broken bone in his toe, etc. I, for one, have had way smaller injuries than that and basically been out of action for weeks and not really wanted to hurt myself further. You know, I want to make sure it's definitely fine before I do any activity.
You literally bitched for weeks when you bruised a rib.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, ribs. I mean, he hasn't gone through painful ribs, to be fair. But anyway, I was very impressed with
Martin's
motivation.
More pain than pregnancy.
It goes to show that he knew the car was competitive. I think that played a big part in it, but...
If it was languishing at the back, it'd have gone, do you know what, let Felipe have a play and I'll come back in a couple of weeks and I'm feeling better.
I still would question I don't think it's a bad thing for people to have genuine concerns about But what if something else happened? Because although we've had it demonstrated to us that Stroll was clearly fit enough to drive the car, drive it for a whole race, and, you know, and last a weekend, with nothing going wrong, that was all fine. But there was still potential for an accident to aggravate his injury, or in worst case scenario, an accident be so bad that he struggles to get out of the car. Because whatever we can say about the extraction test that he did, where we hear that it took a couple of attempts before he got out of the car quick enough in the extraction test, getting out of it under controlled conditions like that isn't quite the same as getting out of it upside down when it's on fire up against a barrier, and maybe you need to be at full fitness for that, ideally. So I still question maybe some of the how sensible it would be to put who is a driver who is clearly still injured in the car. But it was his decision. He performed well enough. It wasn't a wasted seat. He scored great points. It helped Aston Martin be second in the Constructors' Championship. And I don't think Drugovich probably would have done that same job, even at full fitness.
I think this is probably the first time, I reckon, we're probably going to get a chance to see how good Lance Stroll is. Because mm-hmm. he's had a few question marks around the car. He's probably been able to hide behind before. Now he's got a double world champion next to him. Okay, he had a 4 times world champion in Vettel, but Alonso's a total different kettle of fish you got to deal with. Driving
on
it probably
a mental level, let alone a physical level.
Yeah, probably driving close to the peak of his powers as well, despite his age. I think this is going to be the first time you can genuinely judge Lance Stroll on what kind of calibre a driver is. He's had flashes in the past where he's done quite well. You know, he's had a podium here and leading a couple of races, but I think we're going to really see this season, does Lance Stroll have the talent that clearly his father believes he has and himself to go up against Alonso? And I'm with you, I thought he did a bloody good job on Sunday. And just going on to his pains, I sprained my ankle, as Alex well knows, the other week. And I tell you what, I thought I was dying. I was screaming at my daughter to get the ambulance. And that was painful, just walking. So having to get into a Formula One car with broken wrists and fingers and toes, and the guy was a trooper on Sunday. I'm with Alex. I don't usually give him a lot of credit, but I was seriously impressed. And this is going to sound really bad for you guys as Mercedes fans, but I think if he was fully fit, there would have been a chance he could have been further up the grid and passed right, the cars as well. I'm just saying, that's how impressed I was with him.
However, it all could have gone very, 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 very wrong by turn four.
On the first
four.
Lap, yeah.
Because he got off. Where was he on the grid? Was he behind George or ahead of George? No, he was behind George, wasn't he? So George got a bad start and dropped behind Lewis. Stroll.
This is dangerously close to a race review, Alex.
This is dangerously close to a race review. So coming up to turn four, Lance went to have a go at George. I'm assuming missed his braking point, didn't brake hard enough, whatever it was, and went diving through past George, and with the nose of the car, hit pretty hard Fernando's rear right tyre.
He was very lucky at the angle hit and the piece of the car that he hit.
Because he hit it with the nose of the car, and obviously as you can see with the nose of a Formula One car is big and fat and wide, it wouldn't have pierced the tyre. It would have given a big thump to Fernando Alonso, and he had a full load of opposite lock that kept him on the track, but it didn't break Lance's front wing. And it didn't puncture Alonso's wheel, because if he had hit him with the wing part, with the carbon fibre wing elements of that car, he probably would have broken his front wing and given Fernando a puncture. Because after that, Fernando was going, I think George hit me. And the team didn't tell him it was Lance. I would love to have known the point of when he found out that it was actually Lance that hit him.
It was on the slowdown lap.
Is that what they told him?
Yeah, they finally told him on the slowdown.
Oh, I missed that.
he had some killer radio messages. I loved the one when he got past Carlos and just went, bye-bye.
I actually laughed out loud. The thing that it did potentially or almost really hurt was Lance's wrists, because if you see the wheel snap around on him and just the amount of opposite lock he had to apply when he hit Alonso, he's quoted after the race as saying he had a tear in his eye. Because that probably was the most his wrists have been tested. Yeah. And he probably won't have even had... Well, he definitely won't have even thought about applying that opposite lock. It will have happened subconsciously, very quickly. And then he will have gone, ow. Because, you know, it's such a quick... there's nothing he could do. He had to make that correction. And he did it well. But that would have been an extreme movement on a screwed together wrist.
There's actually a shot of him on the when they were listening to the anthems at the beginning of the race, where he goes to put his hands on his hips, and then he pulls his hands, his wrists away, and does this with and shakes his wrists out, because just doing that hurt his wrist. So I have a respect for him, and we will now see what he's made of this season. Right, so can we stop talking about Stroll now? Because I don't mind saying nice things.
I had a final couple of things on the interesting points from the race, but we're already over an hour, so I'll just say them, and we probably don't want to discuss them. Mercedes didn't do particularly bad pit stops. That's better than normal. They were kind of up there. With
no, they fucked up George's pit stop. He got a 2.5 second pit stop.
So 2.5 is a good pit stop.
So no, George, no, not at the moment. It's not. George had a slow stop. 100%. Okay. George had a slow stop.
I read their pit stops were good.
They did the strategy well. They called it. They went early when normally they go, no, let's just go out the tyres and stay.
Okay, fine. Fine. Well, that you can cross that one off then. And the last thing was Ferrari reliability is still bad.
Shit.
The thing that broke was the thing that they changed just before the race anyway. So
George's stop was 5 seconds, says Lisa in the chat.
There we go. That sounds a lot worse.
I knew there was a five in it somewhere.
My point is that the stops that didn't go wrong, like a normal stop, because Mercedes last year and the last few years, an ordinary stop that has nothing go wrong would have been one of the slowest stops in the race.
Yeah.
So now, at least if they've cured that, you know, I don't mind if one of them had to be a bit slow.
Yeah, if you have a look, they were on average 3.5 seconds, weren't they? When you look back over the races last couple of seasons, they've always usually been around the 3 to 3.5 second mark. So it is an area they definitely need to improve in. And it looks like they did look a lot better on Sunday.
Well, at least they've put some effort into something. Let's move on to history with Alex and Brad and Danny. And this week's topic is dominant seasons of the past, because for some of us, we have experienced this kind of season that it looks like we're about to have at other times in the past. So I touched upon the Ferrari domination I lived through in the early 2000s, but there were other times too, and each of us on the panel tonight have had a little look, and some of us quite a detailed look, at some seasons past where cars have been so quick, the result has been pretty much a foregone conclusion before the start. So has anybody taken the McLaren 1988 season?
MP44.
Right, is that you, Alex? Go on,
that's
tell us
what happened.
That's the MP44.
So a Gordon Murray car, after they dropped the tag-branded Porsche engine and went to the 1.5-litre turbocharged engine that was in that McLaren Honda, and absolutely blitzed everybody. They won 15 of the 16 races, which is 93%, which statistically, numbers-based, makes that the most dominant car in F1 history. And not only did they go and win 15 of the 16 races, the race they didn't win, they retired from while leading. And the difference was the gaps to the rest of the field. You think Red Bull won by a big gap at the weekend.
What was the gap? Was it 30 something seconds? I know it was about
massive.
Was about 55 seconds ahead of Hamilton, but to second place, was it 35 seconds?
The gaps were insane. I mean, 88 was Senna's first championship, and I can't remember. Is that
first championship win?
Yes, his first championship win. Is that also? I think that's also the year where they collided for the first time at Suzuka. Is that right, Danny?
No, I think that was 89. Yeah, it was 89, sorry, because then 90 was when he drove him off on purpose and declared it before the race, pretty much.
Fine, okay. So, and bear in mind, okay, so in that race, that was a year later in a slightly less dominant car, the cars were stopped at the side of the road for ages once they figured everything out. Prost got out of the car, eventually got Senna's car going. Senna went into the pits, changed his front wing, still actually won the race from Jabwe.
Okay, I think you've pronounced that correctly.
I think it was Jabwe. Actually overtook Jabwe and won the race, and then obviously got disqualified from it. And that was in a car less dominant than this particular car. So yeah, they literally destroyed everybody. And of course, Connor in the chat has corrected me. It was Nannini, not Jabwe. Okay. But another one of those drivers who managed to get a win at some point in his race.
The chat have come in with a contribution. D Longman 90 says, Jim Clark in 1965 scored the maximum possible points due to drop scores. Didn't even do the Monaco Grand Prix to go and win the Indy 500. So yeah, that's not one we research because we're certainly more of kind of the modern era. We're counting late 80s as modern here.
Well, yeah. We can do this now, we can do this later. I have the list of the top...
There is no later. We're already 10 minutes
fine.
Over time.
So I have the list of the top 11 cars. So I'll go from the bottom. And I say 11 because yeah. I had to add in the 2021 Red Bull. 2022 Red Bull. So
if you get to one that I know about, I'll try and chip in some info.
So at 63%, which is 12 out of 19 wins, was the 2011 Red Bull.
Okay, I've blocked that out of my mind because it was...
This was the year after he won the title when he just pissed off.
So dominant Vettel season.
Blown diffuser, maximum downforce car, weren't it?
Correct. And then there was the 1995 Benetton. Now, I didn't think about this one. I never actually considered any of the Benetton cars, but it won 64% of its races, 11 out of 17.
That's interesting because I've always thought of that season as being very close between Hill and Schumacher. And obviously, Hill should
94
have won.
94 was.
Oh, did you say? Oh, 95. 95 oh, of course. Yeah, 95, Hill was well up. Yeah, sorry. I conflated the two.
Then 2013 Red Bull, which was 68%, 13 of the 19 races. So 2013 was the year where they changed the tyres midway through the season after all the blowouts at Silverstone. And then he went on to win every single race after the summer break. What was that, 9 in a row, Danny?
Yeah, Lewis Hamilton was in contention for the title. It's when he won at Hungary. And then they made the change to the tyres and Vettel just took off.
Sorry again.
And back then, I was actually cheering for Hamilton to win. I was like, end the Red Bull domination.
And the next one is actually a joint win between the 1984 McLaren MP44, which was won by Niki Lauda, and the 1996 Williams, which was won by Damon Hill, where they both won 75% of the races, 12 of the 16 races.
So then, I would argue that 96 Williams, for a rookie Villeneuve and for a not the fastest driver in the world, Damon Hill,
was probably a much better car than they made it seem.
Yeah, for them to do that well, I think if you put Schumacher in there in period,
gone.
That car would be the most dominant car ever. But anyway, continue.
And 1984 has special hearts because that's when I was born. So Niki Lauda was champion the year I was born in driving for my favourite team. So that means a lot to me. And then slotting in just after that is the 2022 Red Bull that ended up winning 77% of the races, 17 out of 22 that car won. Because it wasn't only Max Verstappen winning races, Perez did win two races.
This is why this is so painful, because we've already had a year of this, crap.
I mean, it's 23 races this year, so the likelihood of it matching the MP44 is slim. But I bet it's close. I'm going to keep a hold of this list for the whole year. And let's see where the 2023 Red Bull slots in at the end of the season.
What was the second race what Perez won? I remember him winning Monaco.
Singapore.
I remember that. Ah, that was the one, yeah.
Really good race for him in Singapore. He did really well.
Outstanding.
Then you've got the 2004 Ferrari, won by Michael Schumacher, of course.
This is Danny's speciality, this one.
83%, 15 of the 18. We were talking about this one earlier. He had this title wrapped up by when, Danny?
So he had this title wrapped up by Spa, and amazingly, he won 12 of the first 13 races of the season. Insane. And the only race he didn't win was Monaco, and he was actually leading at the time, and he was braking in a tunnel, and Montoya was behind him.
Under the
safety
car.
He was accelerating, behind the safety car, and he took
remember that one.
And this is... McGrath, and it was that bad. Jarno Trulli won the race. That was how crazy it was.
That's Trulli's only race win, wasn't it?
And only race win.
It has the record, right? So that is that the
is that the one with three people finished
wins at the start of the season?
Yeah, this has got the most consecutive. Well, I think this has got the most wins out of the first 13. I don't know about consecutive from the block.
Maybe he won the first six. Monaco was the seventh.
Connor Edwards is just saying that Trulli won from start to finish, Danny. So he says you're talking absolute rubbish. Yeah, because Trulli put it on pole, didn't he?
I'm not. I'm not. He did put it on pole, Connor.
Schumacher was definitely taken out of the lead in that race.
He was in the lead, truly was leading, and they kept Schumacher out to get to the front of the queue, believing that he could pull away fast enough to make a pit stop. But you're right, truly was in the lead from the start, but Schumi got into front, and that was the plan, and he obviously didn't proceed to go and do it because he got took out by Montoya.
Then we move into the Mercedes era, and you have the 2014 car and the 2015 car. Both won 16 out of 19 races, which is 84%, which is massive, which I'm not surprised about, though the launch of the hybrid era, that Mercedes was just phenomenal. And while we're talking about Bahrain, that 2014 battle at Bahrain is still probably one of the best battles that Formula One has ever seen between two people in the same car going wheel to wheel. And that was absolutely phenomenal. Funnily enough, Nico Rosberg mentioned it
in
the pre-race. And he goes, I should have won that because I was on the better tyre. And he fully gave Lewis props for that one.
More worrying was, can you remember how fast the lap times were when they dropped the hammer and literally left the field?
They dropped everybody. That's when we actually saw, because Bahrain wasn't the first race of the season, because Australia was, because Lewis didn't finish in Australia.
Yeah.
Because he had the engine spark plug go.
And there was a pit, there was a safety car, weren't they, towards the end of the race? He had about 15 laps to run, and they just went.
And that was, I think, that they split their strategies. And I don't think from then they really ever split their strategies again, because Lewis was mightily pissed off about it. And I don't blame him. Then we have the very first, I think it was the very first World Championship, 1950. Very first Formula One official F1 championship. But I just like this because it's a cool stat. So they won 6 of the 7 races, and it was Giuseppe Farina who won that championship with 85%. But the interesting thing was, it wasn't technically an F1 car. It was an Alfa Romeo 158 from the 30s that they obviously stuck in a warehouse during the war. After the war had finished, they just put these cars out, started the F1 championship, and that one went off to go and win the races.
Alex, because you're talking about boring old cars, Kevin O'Toole says, lads, I'm going home. You've sent him. get back to proper Formula One.
However, also, Connor Edwards makes a really good point. I was going to come to this. It actually won every single F1 race it did. But in those days, the Indy 500 counted on the F1 calendar, and they didn't win Indy. So,
right, anyway,
back to another Michael Schumacher car, the 2002.
What position are we at now? Like, which, how?
This is the final three.
Right, the top three most dominant cars ever.
So, I will let Danny talk about this car. The 2002 Ferrari, 15 out of 17, 88%.
Yes, this was an amazing car. So, this has some crazy statistics behind it. So, in the 2002 season, it was 15 races it competed in from Brazil to the end of the season. Took 14 wins, 8 poles, 10 fastest laps.
15 wins.
Yeah, you're counting over the next season, though, into 2003 as well. So Schumacher won 10 races in it, 5 second places, never finished third. That was how dominant he was in that car. Won the championship with 6 races to spare as well. Won it at the end of France to become a 5 times world champion. Remember it like yesterday. Fantastic memory. No, not boo. That was great. They were good times. And Ferrari as well. And I can't remember if this was a stat what Red Bull got last year or not. But Ferrari scored the same amount of points as the rest of the field all put together.
Oh my God.
That was how dominant the car was.
Oh no, that's the next one I've got. So,
right, go on.
Then the top two, 2016 Mercedes.
Wait, so we haven't had 93 Williams. Did that not even make your list?
Nope.
Right, well, okay, before we get on to these ones then, let me tell you the only one I researched, which didn't even make the list. This shows you how many dominant seasons there have been.
The 1992 one isn't on there either.
So in 1993... the Williams duo of Alain Prost and Damon Hill were 1-2 on the grid in almost every race. The only competition they had at all, really from anyone all season, was occasionally Senna would pop up in his McLaren in the race as quite fast. And occasionally, towards the end of the season, Michael Schumacher and the Benetton would cause them some minor inconvenience. But generally, if you look at the average qualifying gap throughout the season, we thought Red Bull's 6 tenths or whatever to the Mercedes was quite a big gap last weekend. This car was regularly over 2 seconds or up to 2 seconds quicker than the next non-Williams in qualifying. That is depressing. Although by the end of the season, some of the other teams did actually close them down to a couple of tenths. But for most of the season, it was well over a second and well over 1.5 seconds gap to the next quickest car. They won 10 out of the 15 races, I believe, but the only reason they didn't win the others were weird circumstances like rain or mechanical failures. So that's maybe the only hope we have for Red Bull not winning all the races this year. But I'm pretty sure that Williams was on pole for 15 of the 16 races and was super dominant. And that doesn't even make your list of the most dominant cars ever.
Nope.
So carry on.
What should actually make the list and actually is the most dominant car ever was a car we covered a couple of weeks ago, which was the fan car, because the fan car has a 100% race win record. Okay, it did one race, but it still
over the season, though, that team didn't have a dominant season. Just that one car
definitely
that came
not.
In.
Right, and then we go. We've already talked about this. We go on to the overall winner, which was 15 of 16 races, the MP44. And when you talk about beating other teams, they scored triple the amount of points that Ferrari scored.
Wow!
Just an insane piece of car. And the thing is, you had so many elements come together for that car. So the incredible Honda engine, they had a whole new gearbox that they were really worried about. They thought it'd be quite unreliable, but it actually ended up being a very effective gearbox. They also had two of the best drivers still to this day that the sport has ever seen in Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost. And everything just went right for them that season. It was the right weight. It had good balance. It drove well. It was reliable. You know, all those kind of things you need to pull out a season like that.
Wait, that was the first. You did this. You did the first. Right, okay. I was waiting for one more. Okay, that's fine. I was thinking, what on earth is more dominant than this? I missed that you got onto the top one. Okay. I was really excited
I record, for the podcast's sake, shall I record a, and number one is,
no,
and then you can cut it in.
No, you can. I don't mind being shown to have not been listening properly. Ivan in the chat asks, which car has the most dominant, which is the most dominant based on average lap time advantage? We don't know. We need to do a bit more research for that.
We only decided on this topic this afternoon.
Kevin O'Toole asked, guys, do you think dominant seasons are more boring than talking about them?
I'm quite not sure how to take that.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure.
Is that an insult?
Well, look, Kevin's still here, and we've been going for nearly an hour and a half. So, guys, thanks very much for your research on that. And it really, the point of that was just to let everyone know that
dominant
we appreciate
seasons happen.
Dominant seasons happen, and it just, although we've only had one race, and as Danny said, you know, you shouldn't write it off after one race. We confidently can, and we totally are. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I hope it is, but just to clarify that, but I don't think you can do. You can't write it.
I'm not looking forward to Danny rubbing this in our face after every single race weekend.
Let's just avoid Danny. Let's just like mute him on WhatsApp.
I won't rub it in your face. I'll do that privately. I definitely won't do it on the show. I've got too much respect for everybody watching. But you remember how much you've given me over the last 7 years?
None. Absolutely none.
You liar.
So what I want, in the comments on YouTube and in our 5-star reviews that you give us, whether you want Danny back on the show to gloat about how well Red Bull are doing, to at least bring the mood of the show up.
I think having Danny's perspective is largely appreciated by the chat and by the listeners. Even the Team LH of you out there that would much rather that Red Bull weren't dominant. I think you appreciate Danny's perspective, and he's always very nice about it. I've got some final things to talk about. So let's go to a screen with only me on, so you can just focus on me. We've had enough of these other two. Before we go tonight, because we are going to wrap up shortly, if you've enjoyed the podcast, as Alex alluded to, you can help us out by doing a couple of things. You can give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And a couple of people have done that this week. And I'd just like to read you a couple of really nice reviews. So one from, I can't pronounce that name because it's all consonants. I'll try. Suljujavizaviv from Apple Podcasts says, 5 stars. These lads are brilliant, bringing a light-hearted, totally relatable and knowledgeable insight into the awesome world of F1. Their unfiltered, unapologetic opinions are refreshingly genius. Thank you, lads. Keep up the work. You make my week. So that's lovely. That's like the nicest thing anyone's said. So thank you for that. And that wasn't one of us. That wasn't... Or maybe it was Alex, because that's why the name's weird, because he's just typed in a load of letters.
I'm not articulate enough to write something nice.
Yeah,
And
there were no spelling mistakes.
That one came in quite recently, and that absolutely made my day when I read that.
That's a nice one. We've also got from McQuirty7, also via Apple Podcasts, 5 stars, great F1 podcast. I like both the hosts and really enjoy the show so far. My only gripe is the blatant disinformation at the start of each show. The fat one isn't even fat.
Unfortunately, considering I used to be 80 kilos and I'm more like 110 and I got a rather big gut, I am fat.
Well, you're not fat.
Yeah, a big band.
We've got fat. We've got a filter on him. So other things you can do for us, you can like the YouTube stream, you can subscribe to this channel, the one you're watching it on YouTube right now, if you are watching on YouTube. You can also subscribe to the new Full Chat YouTube channel. We don't stream on there because there's like 3 subscribers at the moment, but you can add a large percentage to our total subscriber numbers if you go and click subscribe. So search for Full Chat on YouTube, try and find that account. We've also got... Instagram and TikTok that Alex is taking care of. So search for Full Chat on TikTok and Alex will try and clip the most interesting bits of each show or the things he finds the funniest and put them up there. We had some good ones on there this week. And the last thing really is just to tell your friends, because word of mouth is by far the best marketing tool that a podcast like this can have. So do us a favor, lie to your friends, tell them that we're good and handsome and we know loads of stuff, and then follow us on our social channels. So you can follow Alex at Alex Van Gene on everything, Twitter, TikTok, anywhere. You can search for the show at Full Chat pretty much everywhere, or at Full Chat F1 if you can't find us. I'm at Bradley Philpott, and Danny, a recent Twitter convert, is at Danny Henny F1. So I think for tonight, we'll leave it there. We're going to look forward to having our official technical man on next week when F1 Data Analysis joins us. But for tonight, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and remember to keep it Full Chat.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.